The Home Show with Sinead Ryan on News Talk.
Hello, you're very welcome along to the latest episode of the Home Show podcast. I'm your host, Sinead Ryan. Coming up this week, palaces and castles are a great way of touring a city's history. Well, we'll be taking a tour of the best with travel writer Joan Scales. Bloomsday is on Monday. We'll take a look at some of the iconic homes and addresses associated with James Joyce. We'll get the lowdown on the government's new rent reforms for both landlords and tenants, and show regular Jennifer Sheehan on teeny tiny homes you can buy on the internet. If you'd like to get involved in the pod today, well, of course, you can email us at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You'll find me on Instagram and X over the week at SineadRyan100. And we do love to hear from our listeners. Now, when you visit a new city, one of the best ways of getting to grips with a nation's history is to take a tour in a castle or a palace. It's certainly top of my list when I go to fabulous cities. So I'm delighted to have travel writer Joan Scales joining us again to tell us more about how palaces and castles not only show us a different way to live, but also maybe how people lived before. You're very welcome.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on. It's always nice to be on with you. You want to get to the regal feeling, is that it?
Well, I think to the manor born and all of that.
To the manor born.
And of course, when we think of palaces and castles, especially the ones still lived in, it's hard to get past London, actually, or England generally, because there are so many royal palaces and royal houses and all of that, that it's a great place to visit. And of course, even with their Tudor history, I've been to Hampton Court and places like that. It, like, they do it very well, Joan.
They do. Well, you have to take into account that the British royal lineage is nearly 1,200 years and they've had 63 monarchs. So you can imagine there's a lot of history there.
A lot of building went
on. There's a lot of building went on. And of course, we've an insatiable curiosity as well for anything royals. So luckily, certainly in London, it's great. And I remember a number of years ago when they opened up Buckingham Palace to the public.
Yeah.
Because for years it was never open to the public. That only happened probably in the last 10, 15 years. So they do open Buckingham Palace, and it just is open because it's the King's official residence.
It is. Now, he's not there at the moment because they're dicking it up.
They're dicking it up. But they are going to be open now this year. They're going to be open from July 10th to September 28th. So if you're going to pop over to London for a day, you could actually go and see it. And also what you have at Buckingham Palace is you have the Royal Mews and you have the King's Gallery, which is all the amazing gallery of all the art that they've collected over the years, over probably 63 monarchies.
Yeah.
So it's easy enough to book it, because you can book it. There's actually what's called the Royal Collection. And this is the Royal Collection Trust. Mm. And they have a really good website. It's rct.uk. Mm. And so if you wanted to book Buckingham Palace, it'll cost you £32.
I mean, that's not a regal figure.
It's not too bad.
Yeah.
No, it's not too bad. And if you want to see the palace, the mews and the King's Gallery, that would cost you £63.
And it's kind of a day out then, isn't it?
Definitely.
And they have
a
lovely shop there and everything.
Yeah.
You can pick up your little dainty teacups.
You can buy your little china, no less. Yeah,
exactly.
You can. And then, of course, you've got St. James's Palace.
Around the corner, yep.
And St. James's Palace, over 500 years of history, which is incredible. And that's been the setting of some of the most important events in the royal history. So Elizabeth I set out from St. James's Palace to address her troops before the Spanish Armada, when they were worried about the Spanish Armada arriving. Queen Victoria married Prince Albert there as well. And of course, it was where King Charles III was officially proclaimed king at St. James's Palace. Mm. So you can go and see that as well. At the moment, there's no dates. They release the dates as and when they come available. But you can sign up for an email alert to let you know when they're going
to
release.
What's open and when.
And again, it's not that expensive. It's about £30 to go and see that.
Yep.
And then, of course, the Queen Elizabeth's favourite was Windsor Castle.
Windsor.
She loved Windsor.
Beautiful.
And it's gorgeous.
Stunning. In the middle of the village.
And it's so easy to get to. If you go to London, you can take a train out to Windsor and take it as a day out.
Yep.
And, of course, Windsor's such a beautiful village as well, or town. You know, it's a lovely place to go and visit. So that's one of the oldest, of course, because that has over 1,000 years of royal history at Windsor Castle. And it's the largest, it's the oldest occupied castle in the world. So definitely a place to go and visit. If you think about it, it was founded by William the Conqueror. Remember him from history?
It's kind of extraordinary.
The 11th century.
Because you see it now for royal weddings, like when Meghan and Harry got married, it was around Windsor Castle and up the thing. And you kind of forget people live in it.
Yeah, it's actually a home. It is, you know. So £31 for your day out to see Windsor Castle. And then if you were heading north, of course, the palace at Holyrood House is the seat of the King's official residence in Scotland and the home of the Scottish royal history. That's beautiful. And that's right on the Royal Mile.
It's fabulous. At the top of the Royal Mile. It's just gorgeous walk, actually, all the way up.
That's an easy walk to go and see that. That's open all year round.
Yeah.
And again, you can book it. It's £21, but cheaper actually up in Scotland, funny enough.
Right.
But you can explore the association with, you know, Scotland's historic figures like Mary Queen of Scots as well, Bonnie Prince Charlie, and you'll learn all about that when you go to Holyrood
and
House.
And of course, I know you wanted to mention briefly before we go over to my favourite palace across the water in France, is there's another auction taking place of, now we're coming back to Newbridge, another very regal place to live, Newbridge
is,
and Kildare, because that is the home of
very
the Style Icons
too.
Museum. And there's a whole load of stuff there. It's fabulous. I go down regularly. It's gorgeous. But part of that is Princess Diana's clothing collection. And every so often they pile up the clothing there. You can see it. It's amazing, including the famous revenge dress. I don't know if anybody remembers the Christine Stamboli dress, which she wore the night Charles did his confession on the telly. Anyway, that's there. But there's another auction taking place of her clobber.
There is. And in actual fact, we in Ireland are very lucky because it's the only European public exhibition of the Diana Style and Royal Collection auction. Mm. And part of the reason why it's here in Ireland is I believe that Martin Nolan, who is one of the executive director of Julian's Auctions, is from Kiltoom in County Roscommon.
There you go.
And he loves Ireland and he loves the Museum of Style Icons. So we're going to get a chance to see what's coming up. This is all going to be auctioned in Beverly Hills now on the 26th of June. But up to Tuesday evening, it's going to be here in Ireland.
Fab.
So there's fabulous dresses. There's some on display are things like the Catherine Walker dress that she went when she went on the Gulf tour in 1986.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing dress with beautiful falcons embroidered on it, gold falcons, because of course the falcon is a symbol, I think, of Saudi Arabia. There's also that fabulous dress that Belville Sassoon designed for her. It was a multicoloured one. It's a silk crepe de chine dress. And she wore it. It was one of her favourites.
She wore it over and over and
she
over.
She wore it over and over.
Press got very annoyed with her because she kept rocking up in it, you know.
She kept wearing this dress and she wore it at state visits in Spain, in Africa, in Brazil. In actual fact, she wore it so many times that the Daily Mail wrote a story about it saying that, oh my God, yes, it's that dress again. Because she really, really loved
it. So that's Newbridge Silverware, where the factory is.
The Museum of Style Icons.
Yeah, okay. It's a little bit tricky to find, so stick it on Google Maps and you can go. Now, we don't have time to talk about my favourite palace, but let's give it a mention because it's absolutely amazing. And if you happen to be in Paris this year for any reason whatsoever, you need to take a train journey. It's 45 minutes down to
Versailles. And it's so easy to do. Just take the train out of Paris, out of the city centre, and to the Palace of Versailles. And it's not just a palace, it's a whole massive estate. It's 800 hectares.
It's huge.
It's enormous.
You will not get through it in a day.
The gardens are
extensive. It's a whole day out.
Just the gardens alone you could spend.
And the Hall of Mirrors and all
day.
Of that.
Definitely, it was a seat of power, as we know, in France from the 19th century. It's now a museum. So you have the Palace of the Trianon, you have the Chateau of Versailles, and you also have...
That's where all the mistresses stayed.
It is where they all stayed. But it's a good value day out. It's 32 euros.
Okay.
And it's open every day, unlike these other British palaces where it's only certain times they open.
Because Versailles isn't lived in anymore.
It's not lived in. So, it's open anytime. So
Brilliant.
You can book it in advance and have a great day out.
All right, Joan, thanks a million for taking us through those palaces. And it is indeed a great day out when you go and find a good one like that. Okay, you're a star. Thanks a million for coming in again to the Home Show. And you can find lots of Joan on, what's your Instagram handle?
Oh, I'm at Joan Scales Travel.
Right, okay. Now, as I mentioned at the top of the show, it is, of course, Bloomsday, along with a lot of other things happening in the city of Dublin this weekend. Bloomsday, of course, is on Monday because it traditionally follows the day that Leopold Bloom spent in Dublin wandering around and all of his thoughts and all of that that followed through. However, of course, he loved Dublin and there were many, many addresses and homes and houses and buildings associated with Joyce, both fictional, real, in character and, of course, belonging to him himself. And here to tell us a little bit more about some of them and Bloomsday itself is Drina Gallagher, director of the James Joyce Centre. You're very welcome along, Drina.
Good morning.
Now, James Joyce, 18 addresses. And really, there's a huge span of places that probably all, I don't know, maybe a lot of them have the blue circles on them. Rathmines, Bray, Black Rock, Drumcondra, Sandy Cove, of course, Fairview, lots and lots of places associated with Joyce. Tell us about the ones that are the best known.
Yeah, well, poor old James Joyce, things started very well for him. The family were in the money, as they say, and gradually began to slide into poverty. So the Joyce family moved around Dublin City so often, as you say, so many addresses, this fractured, chaotic life. But it meant that Joyce really got to know Dublin really well. He went from Southside to Northsider, and the streets were his playground as a young man, as an adolescent, going to school in Belvedere College, of course. He loved Dublin, had a complicated relationship with the city, but as they say, if Dublin disappeared in the morning, we could rebuild it through Joyce's work, and particularly Ulysses. So three addresses that I thought would be interesting for us to look at, two in Ulysses itself. So the first is the Martello Tower, as you said, in Sandy Cove, the mothership, as I call it.
Up where the 40 foot is. You can't miss it.
I know.
And it is
a
fabulous place to tour, actually, to go inside and have a look around.
Beautiful. And the volunteers there do such an amazing job. And it's so important that these spaces were saved for the city of Dublin, and that we still have it as a visitor centre for international visitors, but also for us to go and see. So that's, if anyone has read Ulysses or not, they often got to the first page.
Very erudite listenership on the home show. I'm sure there's a handful out there.
Well, most people have got at least a chapter one, which is set in the Martello Tower in Sandy Cove. And if anyone doesn't know it, it's one of these incredible round military structures that were built to stop the French invading Ireland when, of course, we were controlled by the British. And they're actually beautiful buildings, but maybe not the best living space. It is a place where Joyce himself lived for 6 days with his friend Oliver St. John Gogarty, who in Ulysses becomes the character Buck Mulligan, who starts the whole of Ulysses, stately, plump Buck Mulligan on top of the parapet in the tower. And there's a great story that in real life, James Joyce, after 6 days, basically he was kind of couch surfing with his pal in the Martello Tower, that there was another guy living there, a guy called Trench, who becomes Haynes in Ulysses. And he goes a bit mad and has a bad dream and thinks there's a black panther wandering through the little round room. It's such a small room. They would have all stayed in the same bedroom.
And they've laid it out with the cot beds. You know,
it looks so adorable. And of course, it's free to get in. And they have so many James Joyce
memorabilia and bits. You would go a bit stir crazy 6 days in there.
I know. 6 days was enough for Joyce. Yeah. So that was in September 1904. So if you think, Bloomsday is set in 16th of June 1904. Yeah. Later that summer, he's out in the Martello Tower. Yeah. And that's kind of the final straw. Now he legs it to...
So that's very accessible. And anybody can go there and have a look. Just check, make sure it's open and all of that. And tourists love it. And of course, you can jump into the sea afterwards if you are... If the notion gets you and you do go a bit mad.
Snot green sea.
Indeed. Now, tell us what else we should know about.
Of course, if you've managed to get to chapter four in Ulysses, is one of the most famous literary addresses in all of literature, 7 Eccles Street. Indeed. And that's the home of Molly and Leopold Bloom. Mm. But this, of course, was a real place, 7 Eccles Street. Now it's the Mater Private Hospital, so you won't be able to see it. But I did have my cardiac check in there. Right. And I felt a bit like Molly Bloom in there, my heart going like mad. But that was the real home of a friend of James Joyce's, a college friend called John F. Byrne. And Joyce went to visit him in 1909, one of the few visits he came back to Dublin. And he visited this house of 7 Eccles Street. And it isn't a huge, I mean, still on the other side of the road, if you go to visit Eccles Street on your Ulysses pilgrimage around the city, you'll see a similar type house that's still there.
So we know what it looked like.
We know what it looked like. And they managed to save the door. So they knocked the building down in 1967, but they managed to save the door. They being the poet Patrick Kavanagh, and they brought it, and Flann O'Brien and all the lads who had the first Bloomsday. They brought it to the Bailey Pub. So this beautiful old door, Georgian door with the fan light above the door, was saved, brought to the Bailey Pub. They declared the door shut in the pub and drank around it for years, as the great Irish writers did. And then now it's in the James Joyce Centre in North Great Georgia Street. So people come and visit the door
of 7
Eccles Street. Right. Okay. And, you know, play
there
pay
is
worship.
A kind of like that. I think worship is probably a word.
Yeah, yeah.
Because even if you haven't made it all the way through Ulysses, there is a huge worldwide affection for Joyce and for Joyce's works and all that he did. And we've had so many famous writers in Ireland. I mean, we punch way above our weight in literary terms, but he's still right there at the top, isn't he?
It's extraordinary. So for Bloomsday this year, there's over 60 global events. We're kind of becoming a little like St. Patrick's Day, if the truth be known.
And it's the weekend now, not just today.
It's amazing that people in Buenos Aires and Bondi Beach and that they can identify with Dublin City and create their own city wherever they are.
Indeed.
It's really extraordinary.
Where can people find out a little bit more now about what's on Monday and about Joyce himself?
Oh, so yeah, everything's on the Bloomsday Festival website. So that's just bloomsdayfestival.ie. And in Dublin alone, there's over 60 events. So there's walking tours, there's theatre shows, there's music, there's dance. I mean, food, of course, the book is full of food and drink.
Yeah. Slices of liver and gorgonzola
so breakfasts and Davy Burns, the centre of the universe.
Yeah.
So lots of kind of street activation, lots of things going on.
Okay, time to whip out your straw boater and get on your costume. Now, I see that you've just, before I let you go, Dorina, you've actually brought in a copy of Ulysses. So we won't attempt to read out a bit. Gosh, I think I'm going to have to try and give it another go.
That's for next year. We'll come back and see how you get on.
Have you been through it?
Yes, I think so. But every time I read it, it's like I've never read it before. Something new appears. It's so interesting.
Fantastic. All right. Okay. Well, listen, thanks for coming in and telling us all about that. And lots and lots going on, as Dorina mentioned there, for Bloomsday. And if you're heading along, well, there'll certainly be a lot to see. Thanks a million, Dorina.
Thank you.
Now, you've probably heard across the news bulletins that huge changes are coming for both landlords and tenants in a bid to try and increase building in the apartment sector. Now, trying to straddle a seesaw between offering incentives to developers while keeping rents down for tenants was never going to be easy. So on the line to discuss whether it'll work at all and what's happening is the Irish Independence, Gabia Gadavacaitche. Gabia, you're very welcome to the Home Show. You've been writing a lot on this topic during the week, so presumably you've got your head around what's proposed, which is more than can be said for the rest of us. Let's start with the current situation. We've much of the country already in a rent pressure zone. So what does that mean? And is the whole country now going to be blanketed with one of these?
Yes. So rent pressure zones, they were brought in 2016. And basically, They are areas of the country where rents are rising. They're the highest and they're rising the fastest. So I think around 83% of tenancies now fall under an RPZ, a rent pressure zone, or I think it is around 60% of the country. So it's only kind of really rural areas that aren't covered by an RPZ. But you're right. So what they're going to change now is they're going to keep that system to some extent. So all existing tenancies that fall under an RPZ, they're all going to stay. And they're going to make that entire country an RPZ in the next couple of weeks. So what does that mean? It means that you currently have situations, as I was talking to one TD, I think Maynooth currently falls into an RPZ because it is, of course, there's a university there, the student accommodation there, highly in demand, but actually it's done per electoral area. So Maynooth falls into it, and that makes sense. But if you drive an hour away from Maynooth to a rural part of Kildare, where, you know, the demand for housing is not the same, that still falls into an RPZ, which doesn't really make too much sense. But really, the rules now are going to be the same for everybody.
It's a rent pressure country.
Yes.
Okay, so tell us then what's changing. And that means the landlord cannot increase the rent by except by inflation or 2%, whichever is the lower. And currently inflation is below 2%. So that kind of creates a stymie for them. Now, from the 1st of March 2026, there are other things that are changing. Two different types of landlord are being recognised. Tell us about that.
Yes. So there's really quite a number of things that are happening. So yes, first of all, RPZs basically means that your rent, annual rent increases are capped at 2% or the rate of inflation, whichever is lower. That is going to stay, but there's significant changes coming from next year. So what are they? So yes, you're right. They're going to, for the first time, differentiate between landlords. So a small landlord will be known as somebody who has three tenancies or less, and a large landlord is somebody who has four tenancies and more. And basically, no-fault evictions, if you are a tenant who's being evicted for something that's through no fault of your own, for example, the landlord, the property is being sold by the landlord, those evictions are going to be effectively banned for those large landlords for the first 6 years of the tenancy. And this is where, for the first time, we're going to have minimum duration tenancies brought in, and they will be 6 years in length. And for those 6 years, both small and large landlords are going to see, they're going to have to abide by the rent caps, because of course they're saying 2% or lower as per the rate of inflation, but the grounds for eviction will also be limited for those 6 years. And they will also have this power for the first time to reset rents. Another thing to make it even more complicated is that if for newly built apartment blocks, the 2% cap is not going to apply, those rent increases, annual rent increases, will be linked to the rate of inflation every year. So your head is fried, I'm sure, at this stage.
Well, I tell you what it does mean, because for the ordinary tenant, when they go looking up My Home or daft.ie, they've no idea if the landlord has one property or 20 properties. So they're not necessarily going to know at first glance. They'd be so grateful to see anything up there. They're not going to know what kind of situation they're in. So they don't know if the rent, if they've security for 6 years, or if the thing is going to be jacked up after 6 years. So like, it is going to be a bit messy.
It's going to be really messy. And the Department of Housing know that. I mean, as you rightfully point out there, if you're moving into a new property after the 1st of March of next year, like, how do you know how many properties does your landlord own? How do you know what the rent was beforehand? And has the landlord reset it? I mean, this is all the talk about resetting those rents. So if you're living in the property for 6 years, your landlord has to abide by the annual rent cap that are currently there. So 2% or the rate of inflation. But after 6 years, they will have the power to reset the rent to market rate. And the question is, what is the market rate? Could be anything.
But we're not getting, or are we, Gabia, a rent register, which has been long called for. So people can actually find out what is the rent on the area, what is the rent in this block, what is the rent in this street, so that at least they know what's going on there.
So, no, we're not getting a rent register just yet. The Housing Commission, which was put in place by the government to basically have a look at the rental system and decide what do we do with RPZs, they recommended a reference rent system. That is basically a system that is in place in other countries as well. And you basically earmark a property's rent based on the amenities that they offer, you know, things such as how many bedrooms, if it's recently renovated, what's the BER rating. It could be anything really that it's pinned against. The government minister for housing, James Brown, basically saying it would be too complicated to bring in that system. Members of the Housing Commission saying, well, look, you don't have to do it as complicated. You could make it more straightforward. So really, they seem to be piling all of this responsibility for enforcement onto the Residential Tenancies Board. Now, we know they have a lot of challenges already when it comes to, you know, proper evictions, make sure that landlords and tenants are filling out their obligations. They're going to have even more work now, and we are expecting for the RTB to be beefed up, but we've no details of that yet.
Okay, and I don't think the RTB do either. We'd Rosemary Steen in, the new CEO, a couple of weeks ago, and of course she didn't know anything about any of this because they have just announced it. Now, for the landlords then, so that's the tenants. So to some extent they get security of tenure maybe for 6 years if they have if they happen to be lucky enough or by fluke find a landlord that has more than four properties. Okay, so the onus is on the tenant to do that work. But current landlords, the small landlords, somebody maybe, Gabia, who bought their next door house as their pension plan, are you saying now if they have a sitting tenant in and maybe they wanted to sell it in the next 2 years for their retirement, they're not going to be allowed to do that?
Okay, so those large landlords, just to be very clear, those no-fault evictions would be banned for them. The rules will be a little bit easier for the small landlords, people with three tenancies or less. They will be only able to evict their tenants if they breach their obligations, if the landlord is facing hardship, or if their family member needs to move in. It is important to say, because of course listeners might say, well, isn't there a constitutional right that I can do whatever I want to my property? Mm-hmm. If you at any point want to sell your property, you will be able to do that. But it doesn't matter if you're a large landlord or a small landlord, you'll have to do that though with the tenant in situ. So you can't evict the tenants and then sell it. You'll have to keep them in there.
That narrows the market into who, into where you can sell, because it means you can only sell to another investor.
Yes, I mean, someone who's buying the property will have to, you know, wait effectively. You know, they're going to have to wait out that period. But those, I suppose, those no-fault evictions, the margins won't be as tight for the smaller landlords. You know, for example, now we have a system where, you know, you can have a family member move in. That will still be the case, but they are narrowing the definition of family member. I think it's just
immediate
very close mother, father, spouse. It's not your cousin or whatever.
Okay. Listen, is all this going to fly, Gabby, or is there pushback on it politically?
There's huge pushback politically. I mean, the opposition, you know, we were hearing some droppings of what the plans may look like over the weekend. And, you know, immediately there was opposition to this notion of resetting the rents. How exactly is the 6 year tenancy going to work? And they're saying it's going to lead to an increase in rents. And actually, the government have kind of admitted that. I mean, they're saying, look, we're going to see, because landlords for the first time will have the power to reset rents to market rates, that will lead to an increase in rents. But they're saying more supply, especially new built apartments, is going to come on the market. And in time, that will push prices and rents down.
In time. All right.
Yeah.
Gabby Agatafkaitcha, if you want to find out the latest and the updates, Gabby is writing on independent.ie and will continue to do so, it sounds to me, for quite some time to come while this filters its way through. All right, Gabby, thanks a million for taking the time to bring us up to date there. Now, the Public Choice Award, now in its 36th year, is the only Irish architectural award decided by public vote, and it celebrates the buildings and spaces that shape our everyday lives. There have been 48 entries shortlisted for this year's prize, and voting closes on Monday. Joining me now is RIAI President Sean Mann. Sean, you're very welcome back to the studio.
Thank you very much, Sinead.
Now, this is kind of an interesting one for me because I think a lot of us see architecture as this kind of closed shop and very highbrow and you know best and all this kind of thing. So to have a People's Choice Award, what kind of buildings make it to the final?
Well, there's a huge broad range of buildings made to the finals. They're located all across the country. They range from housing to public infrastructure projects to places that people live and work and learn in. And really, you know, the Public Choice Award is recognising the fact that buildings are ultimately for people and for communities. And we want to hear, you know, what the public think and what the public think are the best buildings of the last year.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a real, that kind of form function thing, because people have very particular views on what should and is being built in their local area.
They have, but they're also, I think, really interested in looking at some of the innovative ideas that people have and that architects have to, you know, come up with ways of dealing with our housing problems, with our infrastructure problems, with our, you know, derelict buildings and so on in our towns and communities across the country. So, you know, that's what's really interesting. And I think we have a whole range of buildings, 48 shortlisted on the RIAI website. And if people go onto that website, they'll see immediately the Public Choice Award and they can pick their favourite building of 2025 from that.
It kind of polarises people, though. There's a real visceral response when they see something going up in their locality, and they either love it or they hate it. And you know, I think even though I don't live there, one of those buildings that created that emotional response with me was Dunleary Library. Now, I know it kind of isn't for everybody. I hate it. I have hated it from the moment it went up, and I dislike it now.
Yeah.
And other things then, it can be built and you're like, wow, that's just amazing. How did they do that? How did it get shoehorned into that space or that such great architecture? And a lot of that is plazas. So in Dublin city centre, there's now beautiful kind of nice plaza with street furniture thing. Is that the kind of thing that gets included?
I think it is. And in fact, in Dunleary, it's really interesting to think about the buildings that sometimes we have and emerge, and people sometimes they grow to like them over time. Like I know the building in Dunleary very, very well that you're talking about. And
it becomes iconic and it does fit into the landscape now.
I think more importantly is that it gets great public use, actually, which is really fantastic. And in fact, one of the other buildings that's shortlisted here are projects is the Dunleary Baths project, which is a...
Don't get us started on that.
Of the promenade around the...
The baths without a bath and the slope that's too slopey.
Actually, there's a lot of people swimming in front of it in there at the moment.
It's because they can't swim in it. That's why. All right. So some of the other things now, of course, these are all around the country. So it's not just stuff in Dublin. But we have places in Monaghan, the Peace Campus. Let's see what else. In Roscommon. What's that covered space there? Is that like an area of the town?
Public space within the town.
Okay. Okay. Lots and lots of things that people can have a look at see what is there. Have you got a personal favourite or are you allowed to share it with us?
I'm not allowed to share that.
You're not? Okay. I bet you have one.
I think your listeners also would also be interested in some of the examples of how architects are dealing with housing, and whether it's individual houses or extensions to houses or adaptation and rebuild of existing derelict spaces and things like that.
Like with all this talk about housing we're talking about on this show, we've talked about it on other shows, do you think that architects, you know, could play a bigger part in that public discourse? I know they're called in to say, here's your plot of land, build six stories here.
I think we can, and really we want to play a bigger part. And I think also we want to play a bigger part in the whole development planning of our towns and cities in consultation with the public and the community as part of the civic engagement process. I think that's what we're missing sometimes in terms of...
Because you get the buy-in.
Creating, absolutely, the buy-in and creating a vision in advance for advance of planning applications and things going in. So we're putting a lot of work in with government and local representatives to try and get that engagement, that vision and long-term and public and civic engagement into the planning process.
Brilliant. All right. Well, listen, give us that website again where people can vote.
So riai.ie. The voting closes this coming Monday.
Okay.
So as your listeners are having their cup of tea or coffee this morning, I'd really like to see...
Go through
the RIA website and please vote. We'd love to hear from you.
We'll do that. I know I'll be giving my vote and not giving my vote to certain things, right? All right, Sean Mahon, President of the RAI. Thanks a million for joining us on the Home Show.
Thank you very much.
Now, Now, even with all of the new regulations in place, homes and apartments seem to be getting smaller all the time. There was even talk a while back, you'll remember, of garden shed homes. I don't know where that idea went. But could you live in a space the size of a car park spot? And better still, could you buy one on Amazon? Well, here to tell us more is an expert on tiny homes and proof that even the smallest space can be super stylish, former Home of the Year winner with her tiny home, Jennifer Sheehan.
And you can buy them on Amazon.
It
you
seems
can buy a whole house.
Mad.
And I was looking into this last night. You can buy a whole house. It comes with the kitchen and the bathroom and everything installed. And it arrives presumably on the back of a lorry.
It's all a bit nuts.
It's mad.
So these are, I presume, like prefab modular homes.
Yeah.
Famed modular homes we're supposed to get. And like, so, okay, let's, planning aside, okay, let's leave all that because you have a spot, you get the planning, but you put it down, you presumably have to put down some kind of foundation.
Yeah.
And then this yoke arrives kind of ready to go.
That's it. Now, I'm all for modular homes. I'm firmly down on the pro side of modular homes. I think they're amazing. There's some fantastic Irish companies that make them. So
this isn't going to come in the back of an Amazon Prime van,
though. I think so. And if it does, like, it could be the same as all my Amazon Prime deliveries, which are just thrown at my front door with no bell ringing. So there could be a whole house sitting there for someone to steal.
What did you find? Whole homes on Amazon. You found one on Wayfair as well.
On Wayfair as well, which is even cheaper. Okay, so if you're at home and you're on your phone or you're on your laptop, search for tiny prefabricated home on Amazon or on Wayfair and just enjoy the look and see what you come up with. Okay. So they're completely pre-made and they are, like, the ones I found, as I said, they've got kitchens, they've got bathrooms. Theoretically, you can assemble these yourselves, which is to say they come with an instruction manual, right? IKEA style, for how to put them together.
If you are a plumber and an electrician and an architect,
be careful with
this. Fine.
And obviously, like, these are fun to look at. But one thing I did enjoy while browsing them was just some inspiration, because there's lots of images and what you could do and what layout could work. And so that's an interesting way to approach, you know, looking at your own tiny home.
Yeah, if you have a home. And actually, it can be fun, I think, going around even somewhere like IKEA, where they have all these rooms decorated that you can go in and see a study and a living room, which are quite small, and because nobody does that like the Swedes.
Exactly.
So what size are these yokes, Jen?
So I found as small as 8.6 metres squared. And this what now? This, I mean, realistically, this is a garden shed. This is, you know, 2x4, something like that, like just tiny. Okay. So it's not, you know, you're really looking at a little studio room that you could put something in. And, you know, we only...
Granny's not going in.
And we skipped last planning, but you can sleep in these anyway as the current planning stands. Yeah. Up to about 16, even 20 square metres, which is well underneath what you, you know, what planning regulations require again, a room that you don't sleep in. I'm not advising that you do. I will say I dived into the dumpster fire that was the reviews on some of these things.
Yeah.
And my favourite said by Eric from the United States that the house fell on me. So I will be very careful in telling people to go and buy these and make sure you know what
Wizard
you're doing.
Wizard of Oz vibes. Okay.
But, you know, and we're talking very low cost here. I mean, the most expensive one I found was 20 grand.
Yeah,
so
you see,
if you're very handy and you're very stuck, something to think about.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, whether you buy one of these off the back of a van or you really have a very tiny space. And as you say, the regs are modular home size or less at the moment. So there are tiny, you know, new apartments being built. Give us some ideas then on the kind of things that we should take into account in terms of decor, whether we're sleeping in it or not sleeping in it. Because you're restricted in width, height, you know, so it seems intuitive to buy miniatures of everything.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. And counterintuitively, that it just actually shrinks the whole house down. So when it comes to furniture, what really actually works is finding one large piece rather than some little tiny doll sized pieces dotted around, and actually go slightly, not oversized, not overstuffed. You still want a slim profile, but go wall to wall, you know, with your couch, for example, rather than having a tiny little sofa that doesn't take up the whole
space. Tricks the eye, doesn't it, into thinking it's much wider or longer. So one of those kind of slimline velvet couches that aren't overstuffed, the full length of the wall.
Perfect. Okay. And crucially, if you can get one that's raised up on kind of slim legs, that creates a lot of visual space and it makes it look like there's more room than there is. And then you can get storage underneath that.
That's true of the kitchen as well, of course, because they say if you put it up on little legs, And you can, well, first of all, you can get in underneath it to clean it, but also it gives that impression of width and space rather than going to the floor.
So anything you're having, don't have it all the way down to the ground. Make sure there's a shadow gap underneath there, and that works really, really well.
Okay.
And then anything you can have that is dual function is critical. Mm. So we're talking about couches, we're talking about storage underneath couches, those storage boxes, vacuum pack boxes, for example. An ottoman is my favourite thing on the planet. Why would you not have one? If you need a stool or a seat or a table, you can put a tray on it and then you can have lots of storage underneath it, and that is absolutely critical as well. Kitchens you spoke about, and I think one crucial thing with kitchens and everything when you're in small home is use all the height that you possibly can, floor to ceiling. There shouldn't be any gap between the top of your kitchen really and the ceiling where you can fit, because it's just going to be stored full of junk. And there's great storage up there, and that's the same with shelving, with bookshelves, with any kind of storage. Go all the way, lift
wardrobes.
It up off the floor and up to the ceiling.
Right, okay, good. Now in terms of colour and flow and all of that, I presume you'll advocate just having one floor throughout.
Yeah, absolutely.
Isn't that the trick?
Yeah, one floor throughout. And then if you're thinking about what kind of pattern do you choose, what kind of plank, if you're going for wood or laminate, smaller planks are better in that instance. So small repeating patterns.
Really?
Yeah, small repeating patterns.
Again,
yeah.
You'd think the big wide tiles would do the trick.
No, it just rounds the place out. And it's the same for all patterns, really. If you're looking at wallpaper or you're looking at fabric patterns, in smaller spaces, it's better to have some smaller patterns that repeat as opposed to big, overwhelming, you know.
Good
and as much
idea.
As I love some of those huge wallpaper patterns, smaller ones are better.
Good idea. All right. And then the use of mirrors, of plants, all that kind of visually adds to what you perceive as space.
Absolutely. Mirrors are the best. I'm actually writing my next week's examiner piece on mirrors at the moment, and they are the best thing on the planet. I mean, mirrors should be everywhere, and don't, I think the mistake that people often make with mirrors is just hang up a little small one and it's done. No, if you can take up the entire wall with the mirror, I would say at least 70% of the available space. I mean, go edge to edge if at all possible. Yeah. And it's worth it if you can to go to a glazing specialist and get a mirror made wall to wall. And this could go, you know, one full wall of your living room could be a mirror. I stayed in a gorgeous Airbnb in Austria over winter skiing, and they had one full wall that was just a smoked, you know, a tinted smoked mirror. And you would think it was distracting and that it wouldn't be clean, but it was fabulous and it just adds so much depth.
And I know people like, you know, it was a trend for a while to put even the mirror tiles in an alcove.
Yeah.
I've taken to put them in the garden.
Oh, I'm all
big mirrors.
For
because
it in the
apart from anything else, it reflects light, it reflects colour, and it just draws your eye. It just makes it like as if things are further away.
And it doubles all the nice stuff that you have. So if you've a lovely garden with nice plants and you've a big mirror in there, then you've double the amount of nice plants in the nice garden.
Indeed.
And it just makes it bigger. I have a tiny courtyard garden. So a big mirror on one end just really prevents it from being like an enclosed boxy space.
Yeah, and you just have to make sure that after a few scoops nobody walks into it. That's
it's
the other
Narnia.
Half of the garden. Yeah, okay, right. So lots of plants then as well, and a bit of greenery. I know you're a plant killer by nature.
I am.
So, you know, maybe they don't all have to be real, but I think trailing plants can be a nice thing.
Yeah, and you know what I discovered this year? So I have a lot of dried plants and I absolutely love them. And what I love for dried greenery, eucalyptus, for example, is a gorgeous one. You literally just leave it there and it dries out and it's gorgeous, gorgeous greens. So dried plants, if you're somebody like me who's going to kill them, or if you don't, then live plants are amazing. They bring in so much of the outside and they always just create a better feeling of airiness. And
okay, and finally, what was your favourite miniature house that you found when you did your very strange Amazon search?
It's the cutest one, I thought. It was on Wayfair. It's called the Little Cottage Company, and this is a colonial gable little greenhouse, it's called.
Okay.
Wayfair. Man, that was...
Right, it does look very cutesy. It's kind of picket fence.
€7,500.
Well, there you go. I mean, and then you found another one, which is a full-on Dermot Bannon-style windows.
This
and,
I loved. This is on Amazon for £20,000, 16 square metres. It's called the Malvis Container House. Now, container homes have had such a moment because of sustainability and reuse and all that kind of stuff. But floor-to-ceiling windows, great idea.
You've opened up the conversation now again about the modular homes. We'll never hear the end of it. Jennifer Sheehan, thanks a million. million for joining us on The Home Show again this week to talk about that. And you can find Jen on Instagram at Workers Cottage. And that's all we have on this episode of The Home Show podcast. Hope you've enjoyed it and the different guests that we've had on and the topics we've covered. If there's anything you'd like to suggest or a guest you'd like me to chat to talk about whatever you like, well, get in touch with us. Email us at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. Make your suggestion to us. We'll see what we can do. My thanks to producer Aoife Breen. Stephen McLoone was on sound. We will do it all again next week and we'll have another lineup of guests. Have a wonderful week in the meantime. See you next time.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan. Saturday morning at 8 on News Talk.